Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, at episode 167, I'm joined by Dr. John Thompson. We discuss the origins of macular hole surgery, among other topics. A list of financial disclosures are attached in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. John T. Thompson of the Greater Baltimore Medical Center and retinal specialist in Baltimore. Dr. Thompson, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Your first time on the program is today. And so for our first time guests, we have a lot of trainees or people early in the career who listen in who like to have context of the history and, where people came from. So tell us a little bit about why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist? And who were kind of the people instrumental in your development?
Well, I decided to go into ophthalmology during medical school, as many people do. And I actually was down between neurosurgery. My father was a neurosurgeon, so that was of interest. And I also enjoyed the concept of microsurgery. That was the part of neurosurgery I was most interested in. And I knew there was a lot of microsurgery occurring in ophthalmology. And so I took a rotation at Wilmer, a basic rotation. And then I spent some time on a specialty rotation with Dr. Neil Miller, a neuro-ophthalmologist, which again kind of worked well with my interest in neurosurgery. And I really found that I loved ophthalmology when I was rotating with Dr. Neil Miller, and that really solidified my interest in it. I went to the teaching offerings at Wilmer at that time, and they had terrific lectures, and it seemed like people were very interested in teaching. And so I really fell in love with Wilmer and the entire way that teaching and academic research was done there. And that made my final decision in terms of going into ophthalmology. I did not decide to go into retina until really my second year of residency. And I liked the depth and breadth of retina. And one of my chief residents while I was a first-year resident at Wilmer was Ray Oyakawa, vitreoretinal surgeon, and I would assist him sometimes doing trauma cases late at night. And I really love the pars plana vitrectomy, which was a relatively new technique at that time. This was back in the early 1980s, and it seemed just amazing that we could go down and do things in the retina, like removing foreign bodies that were embedded in the retina and performing vitrectomies in patients with vitreous hemorrhages. So that solidified my interest in retina. Also, one of the vitreoretinal surgeons at Wilmer at the time was Ron Michaels, and I ultimately ended up doing my fellowship with Ron Michaels and Bert Glaser, and I really loved the teaching and also the surgical expertise of Ron Michaels. And so that really ended up being the reason that I chose retina, and it's also the reason that I decided to stay at Hopkins to do my surgical fellowship. At that time, the surgical and medical fellowships were separate, and so I spent a year working with Ron Michaels and Bert Glaser doing the surgical fellowship, and I was going to be the chief resident at Wilmer in the first half of 1986. And so I had an additional 6 months, and I wanted to increase the breadth and depth of my retina experience. And so I spent 6 months doing the medical fellowship at what was then called the Retina Vascular Center with Dr. Arnold Patz and Dr. Stuart Fine and Dr. Robert Murphy and Dr. Andy Shackett, who were the main faculty, and Dr. Dan Finkelstein at the Retina Vascular Center. So I had a total of 18 months of medical and surgical retina training before I became the chief resident, and then ultimately, after that, I left to go into academics.
Let's talk. I think you have kind of a unique perspective, given the people you interacted with at the time. It was obviously a very innovative time in retinal surgery on how things developed. So let's talk about, you know, early vitrectomy. Again, I think we all hear the stories, and we're coming up, we hear from mentors, but really, how different was the field of retina, not only from a the day-to-day mechanics of doing surgery, but again, from the surgical versus medical aspects of being a retinal specialist?
Well, there's no question that retina has evolved a lot over the past 30 to 40 years. And at that time, retina at Wilmer was divided into actually two separate divisions. There was surgical retina, which was Ron Michaels and Burke Glaser, and then there was medical retina, which was the Retina Vascular Center. And medical retina was also experiencing innovations. This was not long after the diabetic retinopathy study was performed. The macular photocoagulation study was ongoing at the time I was a resident. And so there were a lot of treatments that were being developed for diabetic retinopathy and macular degeneration, which were also interesting. But I would say my first love really was the surgery. This was a time when vitrectomy was relatively still young. Certain techniques had been worked out, but there was still a good bit of innovation that was occurring in vitrectomy, and it was wonderful to watch how these complex problems, like dealing with difficult diabetic patients with traction detachments or patients with retinal detachment secondary to PVR, how the technology evolved to actually improve the surgery. For example, just an aside is that I remember when we first developed an automated fluid air machine. And what this was an air pump that was used in a fish tank. And the fish tank air pump would continuously produce air. A millipore filter was put on it. And this would provide air to keep the eye inflated after a fluid air exchange was performed. Before this, it was the fellow's job to sit with a 60cc syringe, and they would slowly push air in the eye. As the eye got soft, and they'd push a little more air in the eye. So this was an example of an innovation of our first experience using an automated air insufflation system in the eye.
Well, one of the things you were around for was the idea of doing surgery for macular holes. And again, I think we go through fellowship now, it's kind of this dogma. It's like, okay, you do your vitrectomy, you peel the internal limiting membrane, you put a gas bubble, you may position depending on who you learn from for X amount of time. You know, it wasn't always that simple. And I think we don't still quite understand why macular holes close and what's really necessary for them to close. Take us back to how did we come to this point where most people tend to do this? And again, I was at the Vail vitrectomy meeting recently, and one of the discussions was, do you need to peel internal limiting membrane? And some of the old timers said, you know, there was a time when that wasn't done. What kind of perspective do you have on this situation?
Well, I was involved in some of the early macular hole work, but I think that a lot of credit needs to be given to Neil Kelly and Rob Wendell in Sacramento, California, because they are the first people that really figured out that macular holes could be treated. And it's an interesting story in that Neil Kelly was first to do this, and there was some early work that was being done on vitrectomy for impending macular holes. And Neil Kelly got the idea, well, if it can be done for impending macular holes, well, maybe we can do this for macular holes. So he did a vitrectomy and put in a gas bubble, and it didn't work. It failed. He actually didn't do another vitrectomy for macular hole for over a year. And he and then Rob Wendell, his partner, were thinking about this topic and working. And one of Neil's patients developed a retinal detachment with a macular hole, and Neil was out of town, and Rob Wendell went ahead and fixed the detachment, and lo and behold, the macula was off in this detachment. The retina reattached, but also the macular hole closed, and the patient regained pretty good vision. And so this gave them together, they were sort of had this problem they were working at from different angles, and this gave them the idea that macular hole surgery is something that could happen. And their initial success rate was only about 2 out of 3 macular holes closing, which was, of course, much better than previously, where only occasionally did macular holes spontaneously close. But what they did is they continued to refine the technique. And one of the techniques they put in, and this was well before anybody even thought of peeling internal limiting membrane, one of the techniques they'd put in is they would take an MVR blade, this was in the era of 20-gauge vitrectomy, and they would bend the tip of it, and they would scratch around the edges of the macular hole, not peeling ILM or anything, but, you know, they would scratch around the edges, And they found that this seemed to help the success rate. More of the holes closed when they did this. So they developed this technique of scratching around the edges of the macular hole. But there was also work that was going on to say, well, how can we get a better success rate? Because, again, the early success rate was about 2 out of 3. And one of the other innovations that was occurring back with Bert Glaser and Ron Michaels was that Bert Glaser had the idea that perhaps we could put a growth factor on the macular hole, which would help to close the hole, sort of like glue, as it were, to stimulate closure of the hole. And that's when the interest in TGF-beta developed. And we did a number of the studies at Hopkins and then subsequently in the practice using TGF-beta for macular holes. And the initial results looked very promising. But when we did the phase 3 study, and I was the PI for the phase 3 study, it turned out that in this randomized study that the macular holes didn't close significantly better with the TGF-beta than without the TGF-beta. And so, unfortunately, that didn't work out. It was promising at first. But then, about 5 years later, people started to experiment with peeling the internal limiting membrane. And, of course, it's hard to see the internal limiting membrane. And this was something that was borrowed from cataract surgery because some of the cataract surgeons were using Indocyanine and Green to help to do the anterior capsule orexis in eyes with cataract surgery, that stain it with ICG and then be able to peel it more easily. And the idea was developed, well, maybe we can use this on the retina because the ILM has a basement membrane. And so that's when ICG started to be used to peel the ILM. And I'd really say that peeling the ILM was another major step in the development of macular holes, because what it did is it took a success rate that was maybe in the range of 80% with using long-acting gas bubbles and long-duration prone positioning, and it allowed us to improve the success rate to well over 90%, and it also has allowed us to use shorter durations of prone positioning. And, for example, when we were doing the TGF-beta trials and in the early work, patients were given a 16% C3F8 gas bubble, and they had to be face down full time for 2 weeks and then sleep face down for a total of 6 weeks. And what's happened with the ILM peeling has allowed us to decrease the duration of the prone positioning. Some of the surgeons now advocate brief prone positioning or no prone positioning. Paul Tournambi was first to suggest that no prone positioning be done in pseudophakic eyes. And if you have a sufficiently large gas bubble, you get pretty good contact of the gas bubble against the macular hole for a couple of days, and that's sufficient to close most macular holes.
So, and just following up on that, what do you typically advise? So if you're operating or a partner asks you, you know, what do you like to do, Dr. Thompson, for your macular holes? Assuming it's not a large or chronic hole, but just a standard smaller hole, and let's say a phakic patient, what tamponade do you prefer, and what do you do for positioning, assuming the ILM is peeled?
Well, I still believe in prone positioning for macular holes, and I'll explain more in just a minute. But what I will typically do is use 5 to 10% C3F8, and I'll keep patients prone for anywhere from 7 to 10 days. If it's a larger hole or more chronic hole, then I'll keep them face down for 2 weeks. But I like to do 7 to 10 days. Studies have shown, there's a study by Verma where they put a little electronic position marker on patient's forehead that would record over a period of a week or two how long patients actually kept their head down. And the truth of the matter is that patients don't keep it down nearly as much as they say. But I think there's an advantage with trying to keep the vitreous fluid that's in the gas-filled eye away from the macular hole for a period of days. And there's some interesting work that's been done with OCT when the OCT is actually done through the gas-filled eye. And it turns out that many macular holes close within 24 to 48 hours by OCT in a gas-filled eye, but some of the holes don't close for 5, 6, 7 days. And so that's why I like to use the prone positioning with longer contact, because I think you can get good results, certainly 90% results for closing the hole with short duration prone positioning. But I think to get up to the 98, 99% that I'm used to, it helps to have the patient face down for a week because you catch some of those stragglers that didn't close in the first couple of days.
Well, one of the other things you've seen evolve over time is how the procedures we do and the work we do is valued. And you do help with the American Society of Retina Specialists in terms of advocacy, in terms of how these procedures are valued. So give us, you know, and I'll speak as someone who speaks to my ignorance. I don't know how these procedures determine valuations are determined, who determines them, and why they keep fluctuating. Give us kind of the bare bones. How do, for example, RVU units or things like that, or how are they assigned for different procedures, and how do they change, and how are this negotiated where they can change over time?
Well, I am the advisor for the RUC for the American Society of Retina Specialists, so I attend the RUC meetings. I've done so for about the past 5-6 years. And there is a committee, which is a committee of the American Medical Association called the RUC Committee for Relative Value Committee. And the RUC Committee has members or representatives from all of medicine. And what the RUC Committee does is to try to create comparisons to other specialties. And so it used to be 50 years ago, payments were just based on whatever the usual and customary charge was, which could be anything. It could be a number pulled out of the air. And back when Dr. Shao developed, at the behest of Medicare, the first RBRVS system for the relative value system, then they started trying to compare things to say, well, how much would you pay for a vitrectomy, and is this harder? Is it more? Does it take more time than, say, doing a hernia repair or a cholecystectomy? And one of the major factors in determining the value is the amount of time that it takes. What has happened is that with migration of vitrectomy from 20 gauge to 23 and 25 gauge vitrectomy, the surgery times have gone down. Also, with just improvements in technology and techniques, we can get in and out quicker than we used to. So the net effect of that has been that the value that is paid by Medicare for vitrectomy has gone down substantially over the past 10 years because the procedures take shorter time. Increasingly in the RUC system, time is the key factor. And so an operation that takes surgeons on average 90 minutes is going to be paid higher than a procedure on average that takes surgeons 60 minutes. And this is true across all of medicine. And even our office-based procedures like performing an OCT and reading an OCT, there are time units assigned to that particular thing. So every procedure virtually in all of medicine that has a CPT code has a value that's determined. The RUC committee makes recommendations to the CMS, Medicare, and Medicare most of the time accepts those recommendations, but sometimes they think that the RUC didn't get it right and they may revalue either down most often or occasionally up a particular procedure values. But the RUC serve as an advisory committee to Medicare, and Medicare makes the final decision.
It's just the irony of the situation, like you mentioned, is the faster and more efficient you get, the less they value. And there may be some truth to that, but you know, our procedure codes aren't contingent on time. Maybe there's an expected amount of time for example, a macular hole surgery, 67042 versus a complex attachment, 67113. But it seems like it's still kind of, again, you need to use some sort of valuation, but it's still very difficult because we both know there are macular hole surgeries that can be very quick and the macular hole surgeries can be long. And especially when you get into things like detachments, I mean, a complex detachment could be anywhere from a half hour to 2 hours, depending on the situation and what it looks like. Again, it's very difficult to account for that. But this was accounted for with bundling, correct? Like there used to be a point where you would bill for the separate parts of the procedure.
Right. And the RUC committee really tries to do away with having a particular surgical procedure described with multiple codes. And if they see that codes are frequently billed together, say for a particular surgery, a vitrectomy surgery, and two codes are billed together, if that starts to happen frequently enough, what they try to do is to combine the codes or to just disallow the second code. And a good example of that is that at one time, this was about 20 years ago, when we had complex detachments, that was billed as a 67108, which is repair of retinal detachment by vitrectomy, and I'm talking about an eye with PVR, and that can include often a scleral buckle, but we also could bill 67038, which no longer exists, but that was the epiretinal membrane peel code, which is now 67041, and so we could bill those two codes together, and there's a reduction, 50% reduction in the second code, but we would get several thousand dollars for doing a complex retinal detachment. Well, when the RUC saw that these codes were frequently being billed together, they created the new code, which is the 67113 for complex retinal detachments. The value of payment for complex retinal detachment is based on random surveys of the members, and unfortunately, some of our ASRS and Academy members said it doesn't take that long to do PVR surgery. Complex surgery. And so that pulled the amount of time down compared to what the previous times were, and that resulted in a reduction in our reimbursement.
Well, that's very, very interesting insight, Dr. Thompson. Last question before I let you go. You know, you obviously knew, trained with Dr. Michaels. I think to many of the fellows here listening, or even the younger attendings like myself, you know, Dr. Michaels is a name. We never met him. We never interacted. We just hear, you know, the stories about him. Obviously, he operated and trained in a very different era, but he left a lasting impact on many, many people. And that's obviously established by the people who mentor us, who talk about him. What were kind of the biggest lessons you learned from him in terms of things that you kind of carry with you today? Maybe it could be related to retina, it could be related to just practicing medicine, but kind of the biggest principles you took away from working with him.
Well, that's an excellent question. And I would say that the most important thing, in many ways, my career has emulated aspects of his career. I'm certainly not as successful as he has been, but I absolutely learned from him the value of hard work. He was literally the first person to come to Wilmer in the morning, and he'd be seeing his post-op patients early in the morning, and then going to the operating room. At that time, we actually operated 3 days a week, and this also goes to how retina has changed, because now it's much heavier medical, less surgery, but he'd operate 3 days a week, and then he was in the office Tuesdays and Thursdays, and he was literally the first person there in the morning, and he often was the last faculty member to leave in the evening. He was extremely efficient. He didn't dilly-dally or waste time, but he was somebody that was able to be extremely productive in terms of his work, his clinical work. He would come home and have dinner with his family, and then he would start working on his book. He published two books. One was the vitreous surgery book, which was his first book, and then the retinal detachment, which was his second major book that subsequently was taken up by Pat Wilkinson and with assistance by Tom Rice. But he would then work several hours every night working on writing the books. I mean, these were big books, and he wrote, you know, many of the chapters in the books, and so he'd be doing that at nighttime and you know, finish up at midnight and, you know, come in and be rounding at 7 a.m. in the morning. And so what it taught me is that hard work, if it's done efficiently, really does pay off, and if you want to be successful in life, you need to emulate that work ethic that he had.
Well, Dr. Thompson, I appreciate your time, and our listeners will appreciate these words as well. And thanks for coming on, and hopefully we get to meet you in person soon.
Great. Thank you. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 167 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. We have the blog feature where two of our bright medical students, Mike Benacasa and Amy Klusterbohrer, reflect on the latest episode with blog posts. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as the Android Store. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store and Android Store directly. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well.
Episode ideas are always great, and we appreciate everyone who has left positive reviews in the Apple Store, and please continue to leave those reviews. Many thanks to Dr. Thompson for joining me today. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you listeners for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.